Stand by. I have a very special podcast for you this week. Very special. It contains an ancient interview that I conducted with Rush Limbaugh 31 years ago, and it's extraordinarily historic and extremely interesting. The last time I presented it publicly was on this podcast series back in the summer of 2016. Before that, it wasn't heard by anyone since shortly after it was recorded 26 years earlier. Now, 5 years later, in the immediate aftermath of Rush Limbaugh's passing, I'd be derelict not to post it on this week's podcast. It's even more interesting now than it was 5 years ago. Here's the backstory. The summer of 2016. We were going through our occasional reorganization of the increasingly massive archives at Talkers Magazine, something we do approximately twice a decade. And we noticed a dusty old cassette, remember those? Squeezed in the bottom of a box marked miscellaneous, full of such odd things from the second half of the 20th century, such as record company tchotchkes, cheap promotional ballpoint pens that have long dried up, coffee-stained press releases for long-forgotten political candidates, a metal-plated KMET Bruce Springsteen commemorative concert ticket, and a WMMS roach clip, all unpleasantly covered in dust, spider eggs, and mouse poop. The cassette was marked Rush Limbaugh. Not sure how it got there, but it sure did jump out of the rubble and say, "Listen to me now." So I threw it on one of our old cassette decks, connected it to the board, and what to my wondrous ears appeared? A clean audio copy of an interview I conducted over the phone with Rush Limbaugh during the summer of 1990. I had just launched Talkers Magazine, the talk media trade publication, in July of that year. Rush was the hottest up-and-coming talent in the business, on the air with his national program that launched less than 2 years earlier. He was heard at that time on about 240 stations, which at that juncture was a huge deal. He was 39 years old. I was 42. Rush was still the new kid in town. Provocative, exotic, and controversial, not only politically, but industrially as well. And the jury was still out in terms of radio industry opinion about whether or not a syndicated show could make it in primetime slots on the biggest stations in America. Syndication at that point was reserved largely for off-hour filler shows, mostly overnights and weekends. I was talking with Rush for a print interview that ran in the third issue of Talkers dated August 20th, 1990, almost 31 years ago. Now, please keep in mind, the recording was slapped together on Radio Shack equipment with one microphone, a cassette deck, and one of those speaker boxes, those telephone boxes that were popular in that era. It was never intended for airplay, just as a transcription for reference to be used in print. And I didn't conduct the conversation for the purposes of it being a show. It was just a utilitarian recording designed to be transcribed for print. I guess that's why I eventually tossed it in a box of miscellaneous items, because from my perspective in those days, it had served its purpose in helping produce the print product. I didn't think of the audio tape as having any value. But now, more than three decades later, it's radio history gold. Knowing what we know now, I got to tell you, it's pretty amazing. It contains the seeds of the concepts, opinions, and seminal intelligence that set the stage for the modern era of talk radio. Our guest this week is Rush Limbaugh. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview, the weekly podcast from Podcast One for media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, the Podcast One app, and Spotify, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it, as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Okay, here we go. An uninterrupted conversation with a young Rush Limbaugh, clutched from the bowels of the Talkers archives and rescued from potential disintegration.
The thing that I find so interesting about your show is it sounds live and local as opposed to live and network. I guess the first question, do you find having been doing a local talk show in Sacramento and local radio in Kansas City, suddenly finding yourself on a network, obviously you weren't intimidated by the number of stations and you still have that local feel. That's a very special technique. You want to give us some thoughts about that?
That actually is quite a good question. In fact, not to stroke it, that is one of the best questions I have ever been asked by anybody in the 2 years I've been doing this. When I first got to New York, I was told by, since we're distributed by ABC, and ABC Talk Radio had some philosophies, one of which was, never say where the call is coming from. We don't want to indicate that we're not local. And I said, well, wait a minute. What do you mean not? Well, the whole point of this is that we're going to do a familial national show. We're going to try to bring those things that are in common from region to region and talk about them. And then once we get up, those things that are not in common but would be of interest to people in different regions, bring those things up too. I was not intimidated at all, so I won that. I mean, I to hell with not mentioning where callers are from, that the first thing. Number two, I was not intimidated by doing the show. I mean, you're still in a studio, and you're still in a radio studio is a radio studio, and the idea that somebody might be listening to you in 56 cities, which how many we were in when we started as opposed to one, didn't change. I made a conscious decision to do the radio program exactly as I had done it in Sacramento. Just go on with my same philosophy of finding interesting things in newspapers and interesting things in my life and talking about them. I looked at the audience as simply bigger, not different. My philosophy of doing a talk show didn't change just because the audience increased. In fact, I made a special point to make sure that the program stayed exactly as it was, because that's why it was working.
Well, it's an amazing talent you have, because it seems that also part of the business of network radio or syndicated radio is that the more stations that you have to please, and you know how before you can get to the audience, you got to get to the programmers. The more stations you have to please, the more watered down and vanilla you become, and you haven't done any of that, so I congratulate you.
Well, there are things I've had to drop that otherwise I wouldn't. For example, I do a local show in New York that isn't going to last too much longer because they just picked up the national show. But perhaps the most controversial feature I've ever done was caller abortions. And it just caused so much flack in some of the strangest places, not the small cities that you think would be a problem, but places like Rochester, New York, it gave us a problem. But that is really the only thing that I still do it in New York City, by the way. It doesn't even cause a ripple there. But it's the only one thing that's had to happen. And I got to tell you something. The answer to that is something that I learned early on when I went to Sacramento. It's not something anybody told me. It's simply a philosophy that I decided, that I stumbled into in doing the show out there, and that is simply this, that you'll have no problem as a talk show host being controversial and hosting a controversial show as long as the controversy comes from the substance of the discussion, not the behavior of the host. If I were a impolite, rude, short-tempered, name-calling jerk, station managers around the country simply wouldn't tolerate it. But because I'm not, I mean, I'm probably one of the politest hosts doing a national show in the country, and I actually have conversations with people. People can never call a radio station and complain about the way they were treated. And that, I think, is the difference.
You certainly have a reputation as being a conservative. You also have a reputation for being a likable conservative. Do you have any criticisms of your typical talk radio conservative who is not likable?
No, I don't get into criticizing the people that do this, because I think there are as many different ways of doing it as there are people who do it. And there are, like, I have my philosophy of what works and it works for me, but there are other people who think they must be activists on the radio for it to work, or they must urge people to tear credit cards in half or send in tea bags. I happen not to think that's a good route, but... Another thing I don't do is listen to other talk shows, and it's not because I'm effete or elite about it, but rather, when I started out in this business as a disc jockey way back in the late 60s and early 70s, I ended up copying Larry Lujack at WLS and trying to be the next Larry Lujack and stunted my own growth. And all I bring to this party is my own creativity and enthusiasm, and if I stop relying on myself for that and start relying on others, then I'm going to get lazy, and that's, I think, something I can't afford to have happen to me. So I really don't study other conservative hosts. I'll tell you something else, too. The I had a call today. Somebody saw me on Crossfire, and somebody saw me on the 700 Club with Pat Robertson. Wanted to know, what do you think of Robert Novak? They thought that Novak and I would get along great because we're both conservatives. And I said, you understand something. There is not this brethren of conservatism out there that are united in a cause. We're all competitors. Paul Harvey is probably not happy to see me on the scene, although he wouldn't admit it. He's probably not happy, and I'm sure Pat Buchanan loves being the media voice of conservatives, and is more interested in holding on to that than his cause, although he may not admit that either. But we all have egos in this business. Just because they're former newspaper guys or existing newspaper guys who are also doing TV, it catches you, especially when you're doing TV. So I am not part of a network. One of the things that's interesting, too, is that nobody knows who I am. Everybody's saying, where did this guy come from? And because I've never been a networker. So it's a long answer to your question.
Okay, I'll hone it down to the essence of it. It was also a kind of a vague question, so we'll tighten that up. I get the essence of it, which leads me to another question. You say you were a disc jockey in the 60s and 70s, and you kind of touched on it. But why did it take so long for you to make it this big? In other words, why all of a sudden now are you an overnight sensation? What happened?
See, again, overnight sensation I'm not because of the 17 years of sweat.
That's what I mean, Rush. I mean, I know you've put in all these years. That's what I'm, and all of a sudden...
Now all of a sudden is what I do working, whereas it didn't for 12 or 15 years previous. And I think the answer to that is when I went to Sacramento, it was the first time in my career I'd ever worked for a management which was not afraid of me and, in fact, wanted controversy and did not shut me up and tell me I couldn't say that win and so forth. And I was allowed to develop. And in the process of developing, I happened to get ratings, and they never tamper with ratings. That's so true. Once you start getting the numbers, you have license. When the numbers go, that's when the license is repealed in a way. But it's strictly a matter of management in my case.
So you fell into enlightened management.
Yeah.
Let's switch gears for a second. You worked for a while in baseball with the Kansas City Royals, and one of the things that we deal with in our newspaper is the relationship between radio and professional teams. Do you have any advice, having been in the promotional end of a baseball team, major league team, for radio managers and radio programmers and promotion directors on how to get the most out of their relationship with either the team they carry or just the teams in their market?
Well, you mean as a rights holder? Or as
just as broadcasters who either have rights to a team where they broadcast the team, or just for a promotion director out looking for something to do. In other words, you've been on the other side with the teams. I think that a lot of radio guys don't really know what's available to them in terms of that relationship with professional sports teams.
Hey, the radio or baseball teams in, say, the Milwaukees and the Kansas Cities and the San Diegos, you get out of the big major metro centers of New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles. Seattle could use help. Houston could use them. Mm-hmm. I think the radio guys should understand that the ball clubs are eager as they can to work with all radio stations. There are certain things they won't do with all that they will do with their rights holder, for example. Mm-hmm. But we at the Royals, when I was there, went out of our way to have DJs constantly talking about the team.
Right. I just find a lot of stations are unaware of how open teams are to those kind of relationships.
In addition to that, I think there's a lot of fear among stations that, well, look, I mean, I've worked at places where, I've worked in radio in Kansas City before the Royals. Don't mention the Royals, KMBZ carries them. We don't want to plug KMBZ by mentioning the Royals. But the thing that stations forget is that, I don't think they forget it, but so many cities, so many towns have a considerable amount of their self-esteem invested in how well their baseball team does. Mm-hmm. And so you want to be associated with it when it wins. And one of the ways to be around when it wins is to also be involved with the team when it's not so hot, because things are cyclical, and if your team in your town's sucking, eventually it won't be. And if you've been around always and supported them and not made fun of them and overly so,
right?
There's a benefit to pay off in that investment.
Are you still a sports fan?
No, football I am. I love football, but when I worked for 5 years with the Royals, and the last two were not very pleasant in terms of just enjoying it and enjoying my life. No fault of the people at the Royals. I was just doing the wrong thing, and I considered myself already a fail at radio, so I stuck with it because I don't know what else I was going to do, and this was corporate America, a great organization, and I figured, hell, if I can't make it with this bunch, I'm going to have trouble everywhere. And it just takes, when you have to be there every game 5 years in a row, when you have to win at your job, it takes all the ingredients of being a fan away.
Mm.
I found myself toward the last 2 years, lose, don't make the playoffs so the season will end.
Wow, that's funny. You know, you mentioned, I forgot what I was just going to say. I'm listening to you like you're on the air. You're coming through my speaker. It sounds great. You're a real natural, Rush. Let's talk about, I have an industry question here. Forgive me for that.
But I tend to have diarrhea of the mouth.
you sound very good. EFM Media Management, that's your company, and I know that it has a relationship with the ABC people. ABC Talk Radio has just cut back, or is about to cut back, on their daytime programming for economic reasons. And here you have a company that's really a small company, EFM, doing so well during the daytime. Why a small company like EFM doing well in daytime programming and a big company like ABC having problems?
Another brilliant question. I mean, and I'm not pandering to you. When you syndicate programs in the daytime, mm-hmm. and if you're going to be serious about it, you've got to get into the top 20, and not to mention the top 10. If you don't, you may as well not be up. You may as well not be up and running in a financial sense. Now, ABC is a big conglomerate, might make the decision, they have not, but they might make the decision, look, we'll furnish daytime programming for 56 or 60 radio stations, which are going to take nothing but syndicated programming. But because we've got nighttime programming, news programming, American Top, we've got a whole lot of profit centers out there, and we can perform a public service with our daytime talk radio, even though it's not going to make any money, but we can take the audience it does get and package it with our other shows and go to advertisers and say, look, here was what we are, and you buy us, and you're going to get this exposure here and there. Well, here comes this little mom-and-pop company, EFM Media, with one show. Well, actually, it has Dean Adell.
He's very good, by the way. I want to just throw that in here.
Adell's up and running, so he's established. Here's one show. We can't package with anybody. We got to make it ourselves with our own audience because we don't have newscasts. We don't have other programs we syndicate. This is it. We got to be in the top 20. It's much easier for a radio station in the top 20 to agree to take a 2 or 3 hour show than it is to agree to take 7 or 8 hours of programming. If you're ABC Talk Radio and you're furnishing 8 hours of programming a day, it is not possible that you're going to get all 8 hours every day up in the top 20. So then you got to say, all right, we'll push that program over this program. Then you've got morale problems, you've got ego problems, you've got, you're taking yourself out of the reason you're providing programming in the first place. So it's bigness that kills them in this case, simply because of the definition of radio. Everybody thinks it's got to be local, local, local. It's tough enough for us to get 2 hours out of these stations, but to try to get seven from would never happen. So I think it took us coming along, demonstrating that one show can do what it has done, but five shows or four shows, it physically is not possible.
So basically, the 90s may be the decade of the boutique syndicator and network as a
if you have a show at night, that changes everything, because stations don't mind giving up hours at night. The audiences are demonstrably smaller, so it is more cost-effective for stations to import programming that they're not going to have. It's going to cost them anything but avails, and you're not going to have to go out and hire talent to work around the clock at night and so forth. You import the program. We'd probably be on 500 stations at night, but we wouldn't have nearly the audience that we have now, being on 240 in the daytime.
So you're live when you're on. I mean, you're live everywhere. You have a quarter hour rating, and
we're in the daytime. There's some like stations, especially the Central Time Zone, that have big news blocks at noon, mm-hmm. that are profitable for them. So they DBS from 1 to 3. There are a couple of East Coast stations, Atlanta, Tampa Bay, DBS till 2 to 4. Mm-hmm. But that's still daytime, and that's still prime time, and,
right.
and in some cases it's afternoon drive in some places. On the left coast, of course, we're on at 9 in the morning, which is still morning drive, which is an amazing thing to get morning drive time, but we've done it. But I think it's precisely a function that we're the only show we're pushing. We're not asking stations to give us 2 hours for me, and then 2 hours for a shrink, and then 2 hours. Our company investment is in one show, not a full day's slate.
I just remembered now the question that I had forgotten, so I'm going to back up. You had mentioned before you thought you were finished in radio, and then you came back. A little inspiration for all the broadcasters reading this. Never count yourself out, huh?
Well, no. Never do. I had been fired. I'd been in radio from 1967 through 79. So 12 years. 78, 12 years, and in those 12 years, I'd been fired everywhere I'd worked. Mm. Everywhere. And most of them, stations were sold. And the new owners came in and broomed everybody. There were two times I was fired for, one time I got stabbed in the back in a place in Kansas City. I didn't even know what was going on. And the other time was I had a personality conflict with the program director, which is stationed outside of Pittsburgh. The other three times were just the vagaries of the business. But I looked at it and I said, well, hell, I mean, I wanted to be taken seriously. I had been a moderate failure in radio as a DJ. I had not distinguished myself at all other than I was the guy with a lot of potential if he just learned when to shut up. And so I said, well, hell, I want to be taken seriously in life, and I failed this. Let me go move on and do something else. And I discovered that the Royals was totally unsuited for a background corporate position. And I had a conversation with a friend who said, well, what are you going to do if you're going to leave the Royals? I said, I don't have any idea. I'm so depressed. I really was at my lowest. I was making $18,000 a year. Hmm. That was 6 years ago. He said, well, what do you think you're best at? There's no question I'm best at being on the radio. Well, then go back to that. I said, oh, I've already failed. No. Do what you're best at, because regardless how well you do it, that's what's going to make you happy.
Well said.
So I did it, and remaining dedicated to the desires and putting all that time in, lucking out, getting with an open-minded management. Look what happens.
Right. How about that line between DJs and talk show hosts? Do you think that line's going to change a little bit in the 90s?
Yep, I think that's where the next batch of great talk show hosts are going to come from, is DJs. And because being a DJ teaches you the elements of broadcasting that are crucial, no matter what kind of show you're doing. Timing, brevity, quickness, get in, get it, and get out. It just gives you the basic fundamentals of broadcasting that you need. That talk radio right now has a bunch of people who are not broadcasters. The doctors, shrinks, guys who fix cars and so forth. But when you stack them up against a professional broadcaster who was also a talk show host, there's no comparison. The non-broadcaster stands out like a sore thumb, and in comparison is going to lose. And I think that one of the things to happen in this business, I think talk is going to end up on FM, but I don't think music's going to go away. I think what's going to happen is that music stations are going to add talk, not take away music. I think you're going to find people taking talk calls. In fact, the seeds are already there. Even in the top 40s, they'll take little calls from the 10, 15-year-old girls making requests and so forth. But somebody is going to come along in a major market and either go all talk on FM or mix it in with music. And I think a whole new format's going to be born, and it's going to be DJs that are capable of doing it. And I think that you're going to have a lot of, like, people in the talk business right now, where's the talent? my God, there's no talent. And the reason there's no talent is because most talk radio is very boring. The standard theory of you must get the sewage director in to talk about his problems in the 90s and then go get somebody who knows how to throw a Christmas party, get the latest carrot cake wizard, and so forth. And people in radio looking at those shows and listening to, well, I don't want to do that. That's not any fun. But they're looking at the kind of show I do. Yeah, now I'd like to do that. That's fun. And I think that, and not to set myself up as some kind of a standard or an icon, but see, I'm very lucky. Owning part of my show, there's no program director. There's nobody that tells me you can't do that. It's totally up to me. And I think that's going to inspire people, too, because it's I'm proving here by accident that that can be done, too, if you find yourself in the right situation. So, DJs are the next good talk show hosts because it's going to all boil down to having fun on the radio because it's entertainment, it's becoming more competitive, more stations all the time, more programs to choose from, and it's going to be the entertainment factor of those shows that decides what gets listened to.
What about AM radio then? You mentioned FM will steal talk away from AM. Do you think that AM's future is then bleak no matter what?
No, absolutely not. If you go around to major markets in America today, the dominant station in those markets is still AM. San Francisco, KGO. Los Angeles has the same situation. New York, it's WOR. St. Louis, it's KMOX. You're always going to... People are always going to search out and find the best entertaining program. And if it's on AM, that's where they'll go to listen to it. It's going to be up whether you're AM or FM to let people know that you have what you think is the greatest program in your town, and then you're going to have to sample it. This is a cliche, but it's always amazed me that radio, here we are, our survival is based upon convincing people that the best thing they can do for their business is to advertise it on our air. Mm. We are the lousiest at doing that ourselves. The last thing we do is promote ourselves in the venue of advertising, because to do so might cost a little money. We might make a star out of somebody if you do that. You're going to cost them more to keep them, and if it's any good, he'll get the audience and word of mouth and so forth. So there's that contradiction. I think it's going to be an aggressive station, going to require an aggressive station on AM to let people know, because if you look at it as a shot, as a grocery store, you have to have your product on the shelves. And if people are listening to FM, and if FM is the shelf and your show isn't there, then you're going to have to get them to switch aisles to go to a different shelf. And that you're just going to have to let them know that it exists. And there's a whole generation of people born and never heard of AM.
Right.
But I'll tell you, look at my numbers. Half my audience is 25-54. And if you listen to it, you hear a lot of college students. They hear about it. They'll find it. They'll go to it if it's a good program, no matter where it is.
And that's also part of the idea of promoting individual programs, something that radio has gotten away from. They promote their formats more than they promote their programs. Television, of course, promotes its programs.
Again, you see, that's absolutely true. We have... And we made the decision at the outset, because we're fighting this battle of radio stations thinking they got to be local in order to win. And we were faced with that obstacle from the outset, and our way around that was, no, it doesn't matter. You put on a good show. What would you rather have? Would you rather have a 3-share talking about local sewage problems or a 6-share with a good show? And, well, the audience has got to have local numbers to call and local issues. Well, you give them that 12 hours a day. We only want 2 hours. And do you think people care where Donahue comes from? Do you think people care where Oprah is taped? Doesn't matter to them. On television, they watch programs, not stations. On radio, they listen to stations. And the reason it's so tough is because radio stations, the number one stations, have become number one in large part by making themselves the community. You want to know what's going on in the community, it's the number one station you tune to find out. But... we've had some success in portraying our show or selling it as a television show, and one of the problems with promoting programs at a local station is you make your other staff members jealous.
Well, their jealousy and ego,
right,
is one of the biggest problems radio faces, and sometimes the management is jealous of the talent, as you mentioned, which is really self-defeating, isn't it?
Well, I fortunately have not run into that I've known of, anyway. I know it exists. I've heard horror stories from people who say they've worked for a boss who was upset that the station was known more for a DJ or a talk show host on it than for who owned it. But I think that's rare. If you have a serious businessman, he doesn't care about that kind of thing.
Right.
But you know, it's is not only the ego and the jealousy and so forth, but it just goes against the grain of tradition to promote an individual show other than your morning show. But I wouldn't be a bit surprised if what you end up seeing over the course of the next decade is radio station. Why do you only do a morning show in the morning? Why can't you do a morning show from 10 to 3? Right. Why can't a good forget, I'm not talking about the weather 15 times a second and the traffic, but the elements of a morning show, if mornings are number one, not because of just the time, temperature, traffic, but because you got a great entertainer in there, why not put a great entertainer 10 to 3, too, and a great entertainer in afternoon drive? And I'll bet you somebody figures this out and does it.
Let's talk about television for a second. You mentioned TV. I saw you on the C-SPAN. How did that feel with them observing you without it being a TV show?
The most enjoyable I've ever been on TV was C-SPAN. The least enjoyable television has been everything else. I have yet to be on TV where I've enjoyed it. I was on the 700 Club this week, and that was a pleasant experience because it was nothing contrived or phony. My radio show violates several rules of thumb. One of them is that, Rush, you can't have a show where all the callers agree with you. Nobody's going to listen to that. And then, Rush, you got to get some guests in there. You can't do this without any guests. Well, the show does just the opposite of those two rules of thumb and has become pretty highly rated. Yet people in TV want to put me on and put me in a debate situation, which I never debate. That's not what I do. And then they want to put me in confrontational situations, which is not what I do. And then they don't want just me. They want to share the form. They think they got to balance me with some liberal or so forth. And I think that my strength on TV would be the same as it is on radio. I happen to be an entertaining personality. Put me on and let me do what I do. TV hasn't found a way to do that, and as such, I haven't enjoyed it. And I am not actively pursuing or seeking a TV opportunity.
I was going to say, because maybe you shouldn't be the host. Maybe you should be the guest.
Well, yeah. In other words,
why do you have to have your own show? Why can't you just do a bit?
The reason I don't have to have my own show, but there are people who think, well, this guy's getting a large radio audience. Maybe he can get an audience in TV.
Well, a lot of people in radio suffer from what I call screenus envy. They tend to think that TV is the next step up. It doesn't really have to be, does it?
Unfortunately, it is in terms of money and exposure.
Okay.
If in my radio show, the audience right now is about 1,150,000 average quarter hour. Largest radio talk show audience in the country. As a television show audience, the show would be canceled because the audience is so small.
Mm.
And I think that radio in many ways is pretty low on the showbiz ladder, pretty low rung on the showbiz ladder, and that distresses me too. I don't think people are, you never see awards shows on TV for radio.
No.
A lot of it because it's not national. But still, it's when you succeed in radio and you're an entertainer, the natural ambition is to move on to the next step. I don't ever want to give up radio. I don't know that what I do on radio is compatible with TV. No guests, spontaneous program. TV will not, they just can't function with spontaneity.
How about the appearance? I mean, the radio is the theater of the mind. People picture you the way they want to. Do you find that when people see you, it takes away from your ability to manipulate their imagination?
Oh, well, there's no question that it does, although I don't think that has been my problem with television.
Okay.
My problem has been just the opposite. Television, you convey your message so much on television visually rather than verbally. It's very frustrating to do a television show and to think, God, you were great, and then hear from people, audience, and everything. You looked nervous. You looked unsettled. And I didn't feel nervous, and I never feel nervous or unsettled. And sometimes I may get angry, and so I start cursing. I said, damn it, television just doesn't represent the way I feel, or I don't do television right. I've done a lot of television since I started this national show. I've hosted the Sajak show. I've been on the Sajak show. But note, when I'm a guest on Sajak, Sajak says, what do you think of Gorbachev? What do you think of this? What I would prefer, well, you can't prefer, but like Larry King the other night was on the Tonight Show, and they didn't ask him one thing about, what do you you think of the savings and loans scandal. They instead asked him personal things that you'd ask any guest on one of those kind of shows. I think being a conservative somewhat penalizes you going on TV because most people, wacko extremist, got to balance this conservative with a decent liberalism, and it just is been an unpleasant thing. And it's I think now if I do television, I'm going to have a whole lot of requirements. This got to be done. This got to be, or I'm not going on, because it's gotten to the point now where I don't need to go on if it's going to harm image, reputation, or whatever. If it doesn't feature me in a situation that lets me be me, why do it?
Right, there is that risk, isn't there, that it could take away from the radio exclusivity and image.
Yeah, it's not so much that they finally see here's what you look like, because that doesn't. It's if you go on TV and aren't what you are on radio, you're going to confuse them. Well, wait, which is the real Rush? Mm-hmm. And talk show hosts, I think, successful ones. The other than empathy, I think empathy with the listener is the most profound factor that you have to have. After that would be believability. And if you present confusing images of yourself or versions of yourself in different media forms, then you confuse people. And oftentimes, like I got sandbagged on Crossfire. They tell me they want me to come down here. The issues we're going to discuss, we're going to have a guy from Chicago, Bob Lasser, and... you guys go at it. What they didn't tell me was, what I wasn't smart enough to ask, was that they were going to bill it as loudmouth radical Animal House Radio. Hmm. Had I known, I would not have gone on.
Yeah, well, you walk a line that can be confused to the observer who's not that astute as being part of shock radio, which I know you're not, and you know you're not. Have you had that problem? Well, you just touched on that.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I have the problem not with the audience.
Mm-hmm.
The one fortunate thing, I don't have any of these problems with the audience. I have this problem with primarily newspaper people and television people who are going to do stories or interviews with me. And then to a lesser extent, when you can't really count this, competitors who would, I mean, every station I'm on, there is at least one or two talk show hosts who spend their whole day trashing me. In many ways, and that's another part of this business that I really resent, is these contrived rivalries that people think you have to create in order for the audience to be interested in the whole station.
Mm.
The shock thing is something I understand why people think it, because with my show you have to listen a long time to get it. You can't listen just one day and figure it out.
That's right, and that's also part of why it's important for you to maintain control over your image.
Right.
Because your image is complex enough as it is.
Yep, exactly. But I think that's to my benefit.
I do too, I agree.
Nothing wrong with complexity. There's nothing wrong with always being somewhat of a mystery. What is that guy? I mean, in a communication sense, I don't want people ever saying, what did he mean by that? I don't get a joke or a big charge in having a whole lot of people not understand what I'm doing. But if there is some mystery about, I wonder who this guy really is, does he really believe this stuff, or is he maybe just a liberal acting like conservative, that stuff is fine and in fact is somewhat healthy.
In conclusion, give us an overview of the way you stack up the issues today. A lot of talk show hosts are reading this interview, and issues are like in talk radio the way records are in music radio. How do you rate the issues?
I don't. My show is totally what's on the front page of the newspaper and then whatever is interesting to me. This is going to sound a bit arrogant, but I don't intend it to. I talk about on the radio what is interesting to me, not what I think is going to be interesting to the caller or to the listener. Because I've made the assumption that even if it's not interesting to them, it's up to me to make it interesting. If I'm passionate about something, there's something magnetic about passion. You listen to a guy talking about how much he loves bowling. If it's with passion, you'll listen. You're fascinated by not so much just the content, but the emotion that gets involved. And so I have a lot of people, Rush, when are you going to tell us about the SNL scandal? We're waiting. I'll tell you about the SNL scandal when it becomes interesting to me. You live or die by your choices of what you choose to discuss. My case, I happen to be very lucky in my success, really. I don't want to simplify it, but My success could boil down to the fact that at this point in time, I am probably the beneficiary of the fact that people just happen to like listening to me tell them what I think about the things I find interesting. Now, the specifics of why that is interesting to listeners is something you would have to ask them, but it goes back to the empathy that I was telling you. I think the key is knowing when you shouldn't talk about something. It's like knowing when not to play a record as opposed to when to play a record. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you can never get hurt by things you don't say. You can get hurt by some things you do say or some things you do talk. If you're going to do an interview with a guy, which I never do, but let's say I'm going to talk about, I insist that the audience call about the SNL scandal. I just open to open line. I guarantee you that if you turn it over to that way, you're going to have a dull and boring and uninteresting show. And I am primarily, my philosophy is I'm here to acquire an audience. I'm not here to serve any public affairs requirements. I'm not here to be, I'm not an activist. I'm not here to get people to send tea bags in. I'm not here to change voter registration, the way people vote. I'm not here to expose scandals in Washington. I'm here to have people listen to my show more than they listen to any other show. And I think to do that, I have to be the most interesting I can be. And if for me to be the most interesting I can be, I got to talk about those things that interest me.
That's a great ending. I like it. Any more would be to belabor it. You really gave me a good interview.
Oh, well, thank you. As I say, look, I'm not saying this lightly. Your questions are, I've been longing for these kinds of questions. You're the first guy who hasn't said, how come you feel the way you do about abortion? Don't you realize it's murdering women? And I thank you for that.
I come from the perspective of broadcasting as opposed to anything else. My interest in this newspaper is to provide other professionals in the business with facts and information pertinent to the business as opposed to any personal agenda.
Well, I appreciate it, because I don't have one. That's what, you know,
Yeah, that's why you and I are talking well together.
Right.
We're both similar in that nature. I compliment you on your program. What you're doing for talk radio is great. I think that you and I will cross paths many times in the future, Rush, and I thank you for supporting the new newspaper.
Pleasure is all mine.
I think you'll find it interesting and...
get me on your mailing list.
Oh, absolutely. Are you kidding? you're going to get the first issue right off the presses when it comes. This interview will be in the second or third issue. And we're going to do
a monthly?
It's every 2 weeks.
Every 2 weeks, okay.
It's every 2 weeks, which I think at this point is enough.
Yeah.
I'd like to see it go to every week. But
I think it will once you get it up.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, we have to be seen and accepted, and I don't want to shove it down people's throats. On the other hand, I don't want it to be forgotten. The monthly is too slow. But it'll grow, and I'm very optimistic about it. I'll send it to you, and we'll follow up on each other. In the meantime, best to you, and I thank you for the time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. Take care, Rush.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And there you have it, an audio transcription of a conversation with Rush Limbaugh recorded for a print interview that appeared in the third issue of Talkers back in August of 1990. I'd love to receive your feedback on this piece. Please let me know what you think. Rush went on to become the most successful radio talk show host of the modern era. He became the only two-time recipient of the Talkers Freedom of Speech Award, and to this very day, even posthumously, remains a lightning rod for controversy both inside and outside the radio industry. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you're interested in hearing my weekly 1-hour radio show, The Michael Harrison Wrap, check out mhwrap.com. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison, The Michael Harrison Interview. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Interview is a presentation of Podcast One in association with Good Phone Communications and Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2021, all rights reserved.